What are you doing, poke around here? Just looking. Shandy straightened to his full height. Sort of prodding around. Where are you from? Riding for the KT? The man's lips tightened. Get out of here! Don't aim to be in no hurry. You know who I am? I'm Tom June, and when I say travel, I mean it. Shandy stood looking at him, his eyes mild. Well now, Tom June, I've heard of you. Heard you was a cow thief and a rustler. Why, you... His hand swept for his gun, but Shandy had no idea to start shooting now. His long left slammed out, his fist balled and rock hard. It caught Tom June flush on the mouth as his hand swept back for his gun and his head came forward. At the same time, Shandy's right swung into the pit of the man's stomach and his left dropped to June's gun wrist. The struggle was brief, desperate, and final. Shandy clubbed a big fist into the man's temple and he folded. Hurriedly, Shandy dragged him into a shed, disarmed, and then tied him. The last job, he did well. Then he straightened and walked back to the street. A quick glance up and down, and then he went up the steps to the porch in front of the King High Saloon and through the batwing doors. 5 men sat around a poker table. Shandy recognized the broad back instantly as that of Nichols, who he now knew was Abel Koch. At least 2 of the others were Junes, as he could tell from their faces. Shoving his hat back on his head, he stood behind Koch and glanced down at his cards. Koch had a good hand. The stack of money before him would come to at least $200. Bet 'em, Shandy said. Koch stirred irritably in his chair. Shut up, he said harshly. Shandy's gun was in his hand, the muzzle against Koch's ear. Bet 'em, I said. Bet 'em strong. Koch's hands froze. The Junes looked up, staring at the gangling, tow-headed youth. Beat it, kid, one of the 2 Junes said sharply. You stay out of this, June. Shandy Gamble's voice was even. My argument's with this coyote. I'd as soon blow his head off as not, but if and he does what he's told, the worst he'll get is a beating. Koch shoved chips into the center of the table. The Junes looked at their cards and raised. Koch bet them higher. He won. Carefully, he raked in the coin. This is Shandy Gamble, Koch. You owe me 500. Count it out before I forget myself and shoot you anyway. There ain't 500 here, Koch protested. That's better than 4. Count it. Well, what do you know, Wendy? The thin man grinned across the table. Old Koch run into the wrong hombre for once. Wish Buck was here to see this. Reluctantly, Koch counted the money. It came to $410. Coolly, Shandy Gamble pocketed the money. All right, he said. Stand up mighty careful and unload your pockets. What? Koch's face was red with fury. I'll kill you for this. Empty him. I want more money. I want $120 more. You ain't got it coming, Koch glared at him. 500 in interest for 1 year at 6%. You get it for me, or I'll be forced to take your horse and saddle. Why, you... Shandy's gun lifted slightly, and Abel Koch shut up. His eyes searched the boy's face, and what he read there wasn't pleasant. Koch decided suddenly that this youngster would shoot, and shoot fast. Carefully, he opened his money belt and counted out the $120, which Gamble quietly stowed in his pocket. Then he holstered his gun and hitched the belts into place. Now, just for luck, Mr. Cattle Buyer, I'm going to give you a licking. Koch stared. Why, you fool! You... He saw the fist coming and charged, his weight slamming Shandy back against the wall, almost knocking the wind from him. Koch jerked a knee up to Gamble's groin, but the boy had grown up in cow camps and cattle towns, cutting his fighting teeth on the bone-hard, rawhide tough teamsters of the freight outfits. Gamble twisted and threw Koch off balance, then hit him with a looping right that staggered the heavier man. Koch was no flash in the pan. He could fight, and he knew it. He set himself, fainted, and then threw a hard right that caught the boy flush on the chin. Shandy staggered, but recovered as Koch rushed, and dropping his head, the boy butted the heavier man under the chin. Koch staggered, swinging both hands. Straightening, Shandy walked into him, slugging. They stood there, wide-legged, and slugged like madmen, their ponderous blows slamming and battering at head and body. Shandy's head sang with the power of those punches, and his breath came in gasps. But he was lean and hard from years of work on the range, and he fell into a rhythm of punching. His huge fists smashed at the gambler like battering rams. Turning, Gamble caught it on his leg, high up, but he managed to grab Koch's boot and jerked. Koch's other foot lost the ground, and he hit the floor hard. Gamble grabbed him by the shirt front and smashed him in the face, a free swing that flattened the bone in Koch's nose. Then, jerking him erect, Shandy gripped him with his left hand and swung a looping blow to the wind. Koch's knees buckled, and Shandy smashed him in the face, again and again. Then, he shoved him, hard. Koch staggered, brought up against the back wall, and slid to a sitting position, his face bloody, his head loose on his neck. Shandy Gamble drew back and hitched his belts into place again. He mopped his face with a handkerchief while he got his breath back. There were 5 men in the room now, all enemies, without doubt. 2 of them were Junes, obviously from earlier conversation. They were Windy and Alec. Shandy hitched his gun belts again and left his thumbs tucked in them. He looked at Windy June. "Found a cowhide out back," he said casually. "Carried a KT brand." Instantly the room was still. Windy June was staring at him, his eyes ugly. Alec was standing with his right hand on the edge of the bar. The others spread suddenly, getting out of the way. This, then, was between himself and the Junes. "What then?" Windy asked, low-voiced. "Your brother Tom didn't like it. I called him a rustler, and he didn't like that." "You called Tom June a rustler?" Wendy's voice was low with amazement. "And you're alive?"
"I took his gun away and tied him up. I'm taking him to the sheriff."
"You're taking... Why, you fool, kid."
"I'm taking him, and seeing as you Junes ride together, I reckon you and Alec better come along, too."
Windy June was astonished. Never in his life had he been called like this, and here, in his own bailiwick, by a kid. But then he remembered the job this kid had done on Abel Koch, and his lips grew close and tight.
"You better get," he said, "while you're all in one piece."
The bartender spoke.
"Watch yourself, Windy. I know this kid. He's the one that brought the boys in from Cottonwood. One dead, and one almost."
Windy June smiled thinly.
"Look, kid, we don't want to kill you. There's 2 of us. If you get by us, there's still Buck and Pop. You ain't got a chance with me alone, let alone the rest of them."
Shandy Gamble stood tall in the middle of the floor. His long face was sober.
"You better come along then, Windy, because I aim to take you in, dead or alive."
Windy June's hand was a blur of speed. Guns thundered and the walls echoed their thunder. In the close confines of the saloon, a man screamed. There was the acrid smell of gunpowder as Shandy Gamble was weaving in the floor's middle, his guns stabbing flame. He fired, then moved forward. He saw Alec double over and sprawl across Wendy's feet, his gun sliding across the floor. Windy, like a weaving blade of steel, faced Shandy and fired. Gamble saw Windy June's body jerk with the slam of a .44, saw it jerk again and twist, saw him going to his knees with blood gushing from his mouth, his eyes bitterly, wickedly alive, and the guns in his big fists hammering their futile bullets into the floor. Then Shandy fired again, and Windy June sprawled across Alec and lay still. In the moment of silence that followed the cannonading of the guns, Wendy's foot twitched, and his spur jingled. Shandy Gamble faced the room, his eyes searching the faces of the other men.
"I don't want no trouble from you. Till you load the bodies on their horses, I'm taking them with me, like I said."
Abel Koch sat on the floor, his shocked and bloody face stunned with amazement at the bodies that lay there. He had taken milk from a kitten and watched it turn into a raging mountain lion before his eyes. He sat very still. He was out of this. He wanted to stay out. He was going to make no move that could be misinterpreted. Slowly they took the bodies out and tied them on the horses of the 2 June boys. Shandy watched them, then walked across to the stable to get his own horse, his eyes alert for the other 2 Junes. When he had the horses, he walked back to the shed
and saw Tom June staring up at him.
What happened? I heard shooting.
Yeah. Shandy reached down and caught him by his jacket collar with his left hand and coolly dragged him out of the shed, his feet furrowing the ground. He took him to the front of the saloon and threw him bodily across his horse. The bound man saw the two bodies, dripping and bloody. He cried out, then began to swear, viciously and violently.
Look out, kid!
Who spoke? He did not know. But Shandy Gamble glanced up and saw two other men who wore the brand of the June clan. Pop and Buck June, wide apart in the street. Their faces were set and ready. Shandy Gamble stepped away from the horses into the street's center.
You can drop your guns and come with me, he called.
Neither man spoke. They came on steadily and inexorably. And then something else happened. Up the street behind them appeared a cavalcade of riders, and Shandy recognized his boss leading them. Beside him rode Johnny Smith and Jim Finnegan, and behind them the riders from the KT.
Drop 'em, June!
The boss's voice rang out sharp and clear.
There's nine of us here. No use to die.
The June stopped.
No use, Buck,
Pop June said.
The deck's stacked against us.
The KT boss rode on past and stopped. He stared at the dead Junes and the bound body of Tom. He looked at Shandy as if he had never seen him before.
What got into you, Shandy?
He asked.
We'd never have known, but Johnny told us when you heard the Junes were here, you got your guns and left.
Then Jim remembered you'd been asking him about this here Koch, who trailed with him. Shandy shrugged, building a smoke. Nothing, he finally answered. We'd had trouble, Koch and me. He drew the patch of hide from his pocket. Then there was this out back. Tom started a ruction when he seen me find it. Shandy Gamble swung into his saddle. I reckon the Junes will talk, and they'll tell you where the cows are. And boss, Shandy puckered his brow, could I ride into Paragord? I want to get me a new saddle.
You got the money?
The boss reached for his pocket. Yeah, Shandy smiled. I got it from Koch. He'd been holding it for me.
Holding it for him?
Finnegan exploded.
He trusted Koch with money?
Koch had come to the door and was staring out at them. The boss chuckled.
Well, trust or not, looks like he collected.
Showdown Trail 1. Everything was quiet in Mustang. 3 whole days had passed without a killing. The townsfolk, knowing their community, were not fooled, but rather had long since resigned themselves to the inevitable and would, in fact, be relieved when the situation was back to normal, with a killing every day, or more, on hot days. When there had been no killing for several days, pressure mounted because no one knew who would be next. Moreover, with Clay Allison, who had killed 30 men, playing poker over at the Morrison House, and Black Jack Ketchum, who richly deserved the hanging he was soon to get, sleeping off a drunk at the St. James, trouble could be expected. The walk before the St. James was cool at this hour, and Captain Tom Hedrick, a stranger in town, sat in a well-polished chair and studied the street with interested eyes. He was a tall young man with rusty brown hair and green eyes, quiet-mannered and quick to smile. Women never failed to look twice, and when their eyes met his, their hearts pounded, a fact of which Tom Hedrick was totally unaware. He knew women seemed to like him, but it never failed to leave him mildly astonished when they liked him very much, which they often did. The street he watched was crowded with buckboards, freight wagons, a newly arrived stage, and one about to depart. All the hitch rails were lined with saddled horses wearing a variety of brands. Kedrick was suddenly aware that a young man stood beside him, and he glanced up. The fellow was scarcely more than a boy, and he had soft brown eyes and hair that needed cutting.
Captain Hedrick? He inquired. John Gunter sent me. I'm Dorney Shaw.
Oh, yes. Kedrick got to his feet, smiling, and thrust out his hand. Nice to know you, Shaw.
Are you working for Gunter?
Shaw's soft brown eyes were faintly ironic. With him, he corrected. I work for no man.
I see.
Kedrick did not see at all, but he was prepared to wait and find out. There was something oddly disturbing about this young man, something that had Kedrick on edge and queerly alert.
Where's Gunter now?
Down the street. He asked me to check and see if you were here, and if you were, to ask you to stick around close to the hotel. He'll be along soon.
All right. Sit down, why don't you?
Shaw glanced briefly at the chairs.
I'll stand. I never sit in no chair with arms on them. Have to get in the way.
In the way?
Kedrick glanced up, and then his eyes fell to the two guns Shaw wore, their butts hanging wide.
Oh, yes, I see.
He nodded at the guns.
The town marshal doesn't object?
Dorney Shaw looked at him, smiling slowly.
Not to me, he don't. Wouldn't do him no good if he did,
he added after a minute.
Anyway, nothing Mustang. Too many hard cases. I never seen a marshal could make it stick in this town.
Kedrick smiled.
Hickok? Earp? Masterson?
Maybe.
Dorney Shaw was openly skeptical.
But I doubt it. Allison's here, so's Ketchum. Billy the Kid's been around, and some of that crowd. A marshal in this town would have to be mighty fast, and prove it every day.
Maybe you're right.
He studied Shaw surreptitiously. What was it about him that was so disturbing? Not the two guns, for he had seen many men who wore guns, had been reared among them, in fact. No, it was something else, some quality he could not define. But it was a sort of lurking menace, an odd feeling with such a calm-eyed young man.
We got some good men,
Shaw volunteered after a minute.
Picked up a couple today. Laredo Shad's going to be one of the best, I'm thinking. He's a tough hand, and gun-wise is all get-out. Three more come in today. Fessenden, Poinsett, and Golf.
Obviously, from the manner in which he spoke, the names meant much to Shaw, but they meant exactly nothing to Kedrick. Fessenden seemed to strike some sort of a responsive note, but he could not put a finger on it. His eyes strayed down the street, studying the crowd.
You think they'll really fight?
He asked.
Are there enough of them?
That bunch?
Shaw's voice was dry.
They'll fight all right. You got some tough boys in that outfit. Engine scrappers and such like. They won't scare worth a damn.
He glanced curiously at Kedrick.
Gunter says you're a fighter.
Was that doubt in Shaw's voice? Kedrick smiled, then shrugged.
I get along. I was in the army, if that means anything.
Been west before?
Sure. I was born in California just before the rush. When the war broke out, I was 16, but I went in with a bunch from Nevada. Stayed in a couple of years after the war, fighting Apaches.
Shaw nodded, as if satisfied.
Gunter thinks well of you, but he's the only one of them, and not the most important one.
A short, thick-set man with a square-cut beard, looking enough like General Grant to be his twin, was pushing through the crowd toward them. He even smoked a thick black cigar. The man walking beside him was as tall as Kedrick, who stood an easy inch above 6 feet. He had a sharply cut face, and his eyes were cold, but they were the eyes of a man born to command, a man who could be utterly ruthless. That would be Colonel Loren Keith. That meant there was one yet who he must meet. The man, Berwick. The three were partners, and of the three, only Berwick was from the area. Gunter smiled quickly, his lips parting over clenched white teeth that gripped his cigar. He thrust out his hand.
Good to see you, Kedrick. Colonel, this is our man. If there ever was a man born to ramrod this thing through, this is the one. I told you of that drive he made for Patterson. Took those cattle through without losing a head. Rustlers and Comanches be damned.
Keith nodded, his cold eyes taking in Kedrick at a glance. Captain.
That was an army title, Kedrick?
Army, the Civil War.
I see. There was a Thomas Kedrick who was a sergeant in the fighting against the Apaches.
That was me.
All of us went down some in rank after the troops were discharged.
How much time in the war?
Keith's eyes still studied him. 4 years, and 2 campaigning in the Southwest.
Not bad. You should know what to expect in a fight.
His eyes went to Kedrick's, faintly supercilious.
I have 12 years myself, regular army.
Kedrick found that Keith's attitude irritated him. He had meant to say nothing about it, but suddenly he was speaking. My American Army experience, Colonel, was only part of mine. I was with Bazin at the defense of Metz in the Franco-Prussian War. I escaped and was with McMahon at the Battle of Sedan. Keith's eyes sharpened and his lips thinned. Kedrick could feel the sharp dislike rising in the man. Keith was defiantly possessed of a strong superiority complex.
Is that all?
He asked coolly.
Why, no, since you ask, it was not. I was with Wolseley in the Second Ashanti War in Africa, and I was in the 2-year campaign against the Tungans of North Tian Shan with the rank of general.
You seem to get around a good bit, Keith said dryly. A genuine mercenary.
Kedrick smiled, undisturbed. If you like. That's what you want here, isn't it? Men who can fight? Isn't it customary for some men to hire others to do their fighting for them? Colonel Keith's face flamed, then went white, but before he could speak, a big square-faced man thrust himself through the crowd and stopped to face them.
You, is it, Gunter? Well, I've heard tell the reason why you're here, and if you expect to take from hard-working men the land they've slaved for, you better come a-shooting.
Before anyone could speak, Dorney slid between Keith and Gunter and fronted the man.
You looking for trouble? You want to start your shooting now?
His voice was low, almost a purr, but Kedrick was startled by the shocked expression on the man's face. He drew back, holding his hands wide.
I wasn't bracing for you, Dorney. Didn't even know you was around. Then get out,
Shaw snarled, passion suddenly breaking through his calmness. And something else, something Kedrick spotted with a shock. The driving urge to kill.
Get out, Shaw repeated. And if you want to live, keep going.
Stumblingly, the man turned and ducked into the hastily assembled crowd. And Tom Kedrick, scanning their faces, found hard indifference there, or hatred. In no face did he see warmth or friendly feeling. He frowned thoughtfully, then turned away. Gunter caught his arm, eager to take advantage of the break the interruption had made to bring peace between the two.
See what we're up against, he began. Now that was Peters. He's harmless, but there's others that would have drawn, and drawn fast. They won't be all like that. Now let's go meet Berwick.
Kedrick fell in beside Gunter, who carefully interposed himself between the two men. Once, Tom glanced back. What had become of Dorney Shaw, he did not know, but he did know his second-in-command, which job was Shaw's, was a killer. He knew the type from of old. Yet he was disturbed more than he cared to admit by the man who had braced them. Peters had the look of an honest man, even if not an intelligent one. Of course, there might be honest men among them, if they were men of Peters' stripes. He was always a follower, and he might follow where the wrong men led. Certainly, if this land was going to Gunter, Keith, and Berwick through a government bill, there could be nothing wrong with it. If the government sold the land to them, squatters had no rights there. Still, if there were many like Peters, the job was not going to be all he had expected. Gunter stopped before a square stone house set back from the street.
This here's headquarters, he said. We hole up here when in town. Come on in.
A wide veranda skirted the house, and as they stepped upon it, he saw a girl in a gray skirt and white blouse sitting a few feet away with an open book in her lap. Gunter halted.
Colonel, you've met Miss Duane?
Captain Kedrick. My niece, Consuelo Duane.
Their eyes met and held. For a breathless moment, no voice was lifted. Tom Kedrick felt as though his muscles had gone dead, for he could not move. Her own eyes were wide, startled. Kedrick recovered himself with a start. He bowed.
Miss Duane.
Captain Kedrick? Somehow she was on her feet and moving toward him. I hope you like it here. His eyes had not left hers, and now color was coming into her cheeks.
I shall, he said gently. Nothing can prevent me now.
Don't be too sure of that, Captain. Keith's voice was sharp and cold. We are late for our visit. Let's be going. Your pardon, Connie. Berwick is waiting. Kedrick glanced back as he went through the door, and the girl was still standing there, poised, motionless. Keith's irritation was obvious, but Gunter seemed to have noticed nothing. Dorney Shaw, who had materialized from somewhere, glanced briefly at Kedrick, but said nothing at all. Coolly, he began to roll a smoke. 2. Berwick crouched behind a table. He was an incredibly fat man, and incredibly dirty. A stubble of graying beard covered his jowls and his several chins, yet the eyes that measured Kedrick from beneath the almost hairless brows were sharp, malignant, and set close alongside a nose too small for his face. His shirt was open, and the edge of the collar was greasy. Rims of black marked each fingernail. He glanced at the others, then back at Kedrick.
"Sit down," he said. "You're late. Business won't wait."
His bulbous head swung from Kedrick to Gunter.
"John, this is the man who'll ramrod those skunks off that land. This him?"
"Yes, that's Kedrick," Gunter said hastily.
Oddly enough, he seemed almost frightened of Berwick. Keith had said nothing since they entered the room. Quietly, he seemed to have withdrawn, stepped momentarily from the picture. It was, Kedrick was to discover, a faculty he had when Berwick was near.
"He'll do the job, all right."
Berwick turned his eyes on Kedrick after a moment and nodded.
"I know a good deal about you, son."
His voice was almost genial.
"He'll do, if you don't get too soft with him. We've no time to waste, you understand? They've had notice to move. Give him one more notice, then get him off and bury him. That's your business, not mine. I'll ask the questions," he added sharply, "and I'll see nobody else does. What happens here is our business."
He dismissed Kedrick from his mind and turned his attention to Gunter.
"You've ordered like I told you. Grub for 50 men for 50 days. Once this situation is cleaned up, I want to get started at once. The sooner we have work started, the sooner we'll all be set. I want no backfiring on this job."
Berwick turned sharply to Tom Kedrick.
10 days. I'll give you 10 days. If you need more than 5, I'll be disappointed. If you're not the heart for it, turn Dorney loose. Dorney'll show him."
He cackled suddenly.
"That's right. Dorney'll show him."
He sobered down, glanced at the papers on his desk. Then without looking up,
"Kedrick, you can go. Dorney, you run along too."
Kedrick hesitated, then arose. "How many of these men are there?" he asked suddenly. "Have any of them families?" Gunter turned on him nervously.
"I'll tell you all you need to know, Tom. See you later."
Kedrick shrugged, and picking up his hat, walked out. Dorney Shaw had already vanished. Yet when he reached the veranda, Connie Duane still sat there, only now she was not reading, merely staring over the top of her book at the dusty, sun-swept street. He paused, hat in hand. "Have you been in Mustang long?" She looked up, studying him for a long minute before she spoke. "Why, no, not long. Yet long enough to learn to love and hate." She turned her eyes to the hills, then back to him. "I love this country, Captain. Can you understand that? I'm a city girl, born and bred in the city. And yet when I first saw those red rock walls, those lovely mesas, the desert, the Indian ponies, why, Captain, I fell in love. This is my country. I could stay here forever." Surprised, he studied her again, more pleased than he could easily have admitted. "That's the way I feel about it. But you said to love and to hate. You love the country. Now what do you hate?" "Some of the men who infest it, Captain. Some of the human wolves it breeds. And others, bred somewhere, who come to it to feed off the ones who came earlier, and were more courageous but are less knowing, less tricky." More and more surprised, he leaned on the rail. "I don't know if I follow you, Miss Duane. I haven't been here long, but I haven't met any of those you speak of." She looked up at him, her eyes frank and cool. Slowly she closed her book, stood up and turned toward the door. You haven't, Captain? Her voice was suddenly cool. Are you sure? At this moment, I'm wondering if you're not one of them. She stepped through the door and was gone. Tom Kedrick stood for a moment, staring after her. When he turned away, it was with a puzzled frown on his face. Now, what did she mean by that? What did she know about him that could incline her to such a view? Despite himself, he was both irritated and disturbed. Coupled with the anger of the man Peters, it offered a new element to his thinking. Yet how could Consuelo Duane, John Gunter's niece, have the same opinions owned by Peters? No doubt they stemmed from different sources. Troubled, he walked on down the street of the town and stood there, looking around. He had not yet changed into Western clothes and still wore his flat-crowned, flat-brimmed black hat, which he would retain, and a tailored gray suit with black Western-style boots. Pausing on the corner, he slowly rolled a cigarette and lighted it. He made a dashing, handsome figure as he stood there in his perfectly fitted suit, his lean, bronzed face, strong, intelligent, and interesting. Both men and women glanced at him, and most of them twice. His military erectness, broad shoulders, and cool self-possession were enough to mark him in any crowd. His mind had escaped his immediate problem now and was lost in the never-ending excitement of a crowded Western street. All jammed together, without rhyme or reason, such places held all types and manner of men. For the West was, of all things, a melting pot. Adventurers came to seek gold, new lands, excitement. Gamblers, women of the oldest and most active profession, thugs, gunmen, cow rustlers, horse thieves, miners, cowhands, freighters, and just drifters all crowded the street. That bearded man in the sun-faded red wool shirt might, if prompted, start to spout Shakespeare. The slender young man talking to the girl in the buckboard might have graduated from Oxford, and the white-faced gambler might be the scion of an old southern family. There was no knowing in this strangest, most exciting, and colorful of countries during its most exciting time. All classes, types, and nationalities had come west, all looking for the pot of gold at the foot of any available rainbow, and most of them were more engrossed in the looking than the finding. All men wore guns, most of them in plain sight. Few of them would hesitate to use them if need be. The man who fought with his fists was a rarity, although present. A big man lurched from the crowd. Tom glanced at him, and their eyes met. Obviously, the man had been drinking and was hunting trouble, and as their eyes met, he stopped. Sensing trouble, other passers-by stopped too.
So?
The big man stood, wide-legged, his sleeves rolled above thick, hairy forearms.
Another one of them darn thieves. Land stealers?
He chuckled suddenly.
Well, your murderer ain't with you now to save your bacon, and I aim to give my share you right now. Reach.
Kedrick's mouth was dry, but his eyes were calm. He held the cigarette in his right hand near his mouth. Sorry, friend. I'm not packing a gun. If I were, I'd still not kill you. You're mistaken, man, about that land. My people have a rightful claim to it.
Have they now?
The big man came a step nearer, his hand on the butt of his gun.
The right to take from a man the land he's sweated over? To tear down his home? To run his kids out on the desert?
Despite the fact that the man was drunk, Tom Kedrick saw beyond it a sullen and honest fury. And fear. Not fear of him, for this man was not afraid, nor would he be afraid of even Dorney Shaw. He was afraid for his family. The realization of that fact struck Kedrick and disturbed him anew. More and more, he was questioning the course he had chosen. The crowd murmured and was ugly. Obviously, their sympathies were with the big man and against Kedrick. A low murmur, then a rustling in the crowd, and suddenly, deathly silence. Kedrick saw the big man's face pale and heard someone whisper hoarsely,
"Look out, Bert! There's Dorney Shaw!"
Kedrick was suddenly aware that Shaw had moved up beside him.
"Let me have him, Captain." Shaw's voice was low. "It's time this here was stopped."
Kedrick's voice was sharp and cold.
No. Move back, Shaw. I'll fight my own battles.
But you ain't got a gun. Shaw's voice was sharper in protest. Bert showed no desire to retreat. That the appearance of Shaw was a shock was evident, but this man was not Peters. He was going to stand his ground. His eyes, wary now but puzzled, shifted from Shaw to Kedrick, and Tom took an easy step forward, putting him almost within arm's length of Bert.
"Shaw's not in this, Bert," he said quietly. "I've no quarrel with you, man, but no man calls me without getting his chance. If you want what I've got, don't let the fact that I'm not armed stop you. I wanted no quarrel, but you do, so have at it."
Suspicion was in the big man's eyes. He had seen guns come from nowhere before, and especially from men dressed as this one did. He was not prepared to believe that Kedrick would face him unarmed.
"You got a gun," he snapped. "You got a hideout, you damn coyote."
He jerked his gun from the holster, and in that instant Tom Kedrick moved. The edge of his left hand chopped down on the rising wrist of the gun hand, and he stepped in, whipping up his right in an uppercut that packed all the power in his lean, whipcord body. The punch was fast and perfectly timed, and the crack of it on the corner of Bert's jaw was like the crack of a teamster's whip. Bert hit the walk just one split second after his gun, and hit it right on his shoulder blades. Coolly, then, Kedrick stooped and picked up the gun. An old 1851 Model Navy revolver. He stood over the man, his eyes searching the crowd. Wherever he looked, there were hard, blank faces. He glanced down at Bert, and the big man was slowly sitting up, shaking his big head. He started to lift his right hand and gave a sudden gasp of pain. He stared at it, then looked up.
"You broke my wrist," he said. "It's busted, and me with my plowing to do."
"Better get up," Kedrick said quietly. "You asked for it, you know."
When the man was on his feet, Kedrick calmly handed him his six-shooter. Their eyes met over the gun, and Kedrick smiled.
"Take it. Drop it down in your holster and forget it. I'm not worried. You're not the man to shoot another in the back."
Calmly, he turned his back and walked slowly away down the street. Before the St. James, he paused. His fingers trembled ever so slightly as he took out a paper and shook tobacco into it.
"That was slick."
It was Dorney Shaw's soft voice. His brown eyes probed Kedrick's face curiously.
"Never seen the like. Just slapped his wrist and busted it."
With Keith, John Gunter had come up, smiling broadly.
"Saw it all, son. That'll do more good than a dozen killings. Just like Tom Smith used to do. Old Bear Creek Tom, who handled some of the toughest rannies that ever came over the trail with nothing but his fists."
"What would you have done if he had jerked that gun back and fired?" Keith asked. Kedrick shrugged, wanting to forget it. "He hadn't time," he said quietly. "But there are answers to that, too."
"Some of the boys will be up to see you tonight, Tom," Gunter advised. "I've had Dorney notify Shad, Fessenden, and some of the others. Better figure on a ride out there tomorrow. Make it a start, anyway. Just sort of ride around with some of the boys to let them know we ain't fooling."
Kedrick nodded, and after a brief discussion went inside into his room. Certainly, he reflected, the West had not changed. Things still happened fast out here. He pulled off his coat, waistcoat, and vest, then his boots. Stripped to the waist, he sat down on the bed and dug into his valise. For a couple of minutes, he dug around and then drew out two well-oiled holsters and gun belts. In the holsters were two 44 Russian pistols, a Smith & Wesson gun manufactured on order for the Russian army, and one of the most accurate shooting pistols on the market. Carefully, he checked the loads, then returned the guns to their holsters and put them aside. Digging around again, he drew out a second pair of guns, holsters, and belts. Each of these was a Walch 12-shot Navy pistol, caliber 36, and almost identical in size and weight to the Frontier Colt or the 44 Russian. Rarely seen in the West and disliked by some, Kedrick had used the guns on many occasions and found them always satisfactory. There were times when the added firepower was a big help. As for stopping power, the 36 in the hands of a good marksman lacked but little offered by the heavier 44 caliber.
Yet there was a time and a place for everything, and these guns had an added tactical value. Carefully, he wrapped them once more and returned them to the bottom of his valise. Then he belted on the 44 Russians and, digging out his Winchester, carefully cleaned, oiled, and loaded it. Then he sat down on the bed and was about to remove his guns again and stretch out when there was a light tap at the door.
"Come in," said Kedrick, "and if you're an enemy, I'll be pleased to know you."
The door opened and closed all in a breath. The man that stood with his back to it, facing Kedrick, was scarcely 5'4", yet almost as broad as he was tall, but all of it sheer power of bone and muscle, and not an ounce of fat anywhere. His broad brown face might have been carved from stone, and the bristle of short-cropped hair above it was black as a crow's wing. The man's neck spread to broad, thick shoulders. On his right hip, he packed a gun. In his hand, he held a narrow-brimmed hard hat. Kedrick leapt to his feet.
"Day!"
The name was an explosion of sound.
"Day Reed, what are you doing in this country?"
"Ah, so it's that you ask, is it? But it's trouble there is, much of trouble, and you that's by way of bringing it."
"Me?"
Kedrick waved to a chair.
"Tell me what you mean."
The Welshman searched his face, then seated himself, his huge palms resting on his knees. His legs were thick-muscled and bowed.
"It's the man Burrick you're with, and you've the job taken to run us off the land. There has changed you are, Tom, and for the worse."
"You're one of them?
You're on the land Berwick, Keith, and Gunter claim?"
"I am that,
and a sight of work I've done on it, too. And now the rascals would be putting me off.
Well, they'll have a fight to move me, and you too, if you're to stay one of them."
Kedrick studied the Welshman thoughtfully. All his doubts had come to a head now, for this man he knew. His own father had been Welsh, his mother Irish, and Day Reed had been friend to them both. Day had come from the old country with his father, had worked beside him when he courted his mother, and although much younger than Gwilym Kedrick, he had come west with him too.
"Day," he said slowly, "I'll admit that today I've been having doubts of all this. You see, I knew John Gunter after the war, and I took a herd of cattle over the trail for a friend of his. There was trouble that year, the Indians holding every herd and demanding large numbers of cattle for themselves, the rustlers trying to steal whole herds, and others demanding money for passage across land they claimed. I took my herd through without paying anything but a few fat beefs for the Indians, who richly deserved them. But not what they demanded. They got what I wanted to give. Gunter remembered me from that and knew something of my war record, so when he approached me in New Orleans, his proposition sounded good. And this is what he told me. His firm, Berwick, Keith, and Gunter, had filed application for the survey and purchase of all or parts of nearly 300 sections of land. They made oath that this land was swamp land or overflowed and came under the General Land Office ruling that it was land too wet for irrigation at seeding time, though later requiring irrigation and therefore subject to sale as swamp. He went on to say that they had arranged to buy the land, but that a bunch of squatters were on it who refused to leave. He wanted to hire me to lead a force to see the land was cleared. And he said that as most of them were rustlers, outlaws, or renegades of one sort or another, there would be fighting, and force would be necessary. Day nodded. Right he was as to the fighting, but renegades, no. Well, he smiled grimly past his pipe. I'd not be saying that now, but there's mighty few. There are bad apples in all barrels, one or two. But most of us be good people, with homes built and crops in. And did he tell you that their oath was given that the land was unoccupied? Well, given it was. And let me tell you, 94 sections have homes on them. Some mighty poor, but homes. Shrewd they were with the planning. 6 months the notices must be posted, but they posted them in fine print, and where few men could read. And 3 months are by before anything is noticed, and by accident only. So now they come to force us off, to be sure the land is unoccupied and ready. As for swamp, 'tis desert now, and always desert. Crops can only be grown where the water is, and little enough of that. Day shook his head and knocked out his short-stemmed pipe. Money we've none to fight them, no lawyers among us, although one who's as likely to help, a newspaper man he is.
But what good without money to send him to Washington? The Welshman's face was gloomy.
They'll beat us, that we know. They've money to fight us with, and tough men. But some of them will die on the ground and pay for it with their red blood. And those among us there are who plan to see 'tis not only the hired gunners who die, but the high and mighty. You too, lad, if among them you stay.
Kedrick was thoughtful.
Day, this story is different from the one I've heard. I'll have to think about it. And tomorrow we ride out to look the land over and show ourselves.
Reed looked up sharply.
Don't you be one of them. We've plans made to see no man gets off alive, if we can help it.
Look, man, Kedrick leaned forward. You've got to change that. I mean, for now. Tomorrow it's mainly a show of force, a threat. There will be no shooting, I promise you. We'll ride out, look around, then ride back. If they're shooting, your men will start it. Now you go back to them and stop it. Let them hold off, and let me look around.
Day Reed got slowly to his feet. Ah, lad, 'tis good to see you again, but under happier circumstances, I wish it were. I'd like to have you to the house for supper, and a game, as in the old days. You'd like the wife I have.
You? Married?
Kedrick was incredulous. I'd never believe it.
Day grinned sheepishly.
Married it is, all right, and happy, Tom. His face darkened. Happy if I can keep my ground. But one promise I make. If your bloody riders take my ground, my body will be there, where they ride past, and it will be not alone, but with dead men around.
Long after the Welshman had gone, Tom Kedrick sat silently and studied the street beyond the window. Was this what Consuelo Duane had meant? Whose side was she on? First, he must ride over the land, see it for himself, and then he must have another talk with Gunter. Uneasily, he looked again at the faces of the men in his mind. The cold, wolf-like face of Keith. The fat, slobby face of Berwick, underlined with harsh, domineering power. And the face of Gunter, friendly, affable, but was it not a little sly? From outside came the noise of a tinny piano and a strident female voice singing. Chips rattled, and there was the constant rustle of movement and of booted feet. Somewhere a spur jingled, and Tom Kedrick got to his feet and slipped into a shirt. When he was dressed again, with his guns belted on, he left his room and walked down the hall to the lobby. From a room beside his, a man stepped and stared after him. It was Dorney Shaw.
3. Only the dweller in the deserts can know such mornings, such silences, drowsy with warmth and the song of cicadas. Nowhere but in the desert shall the far miles stand out so clearly, the mesas, towers, and cliffs so boldly outlined. Nowhere will the cloud shadows island themselves as on the desert, offering their brief respite from the sun. 6 riders, their saddles creaking, 6 hard men, each lost in the twisted arroyos of his own thoughts, were emerging upon the broad desert. They were men who had used their guns to kill, and would use them so again. Some of them were already doomed by the relentless and ruthless tide of events, and to the others their time too would come. Each of them was alone, as men who live by the gun are always alone. Each man a potential enemy, each shadow a danger. They rode jealously, their gestures marked by restraint, their eyes by watchfulness. A horse blew through his nostrils, a hoof clicked on a stone. Someone shifted in his saddle and sighed. These were the only sounds. Tom Kedrick rode an Appaloosa gelding, 15 hands even, with iron-gray forequarters and starkly white hindquarters splashed with tear-shaped spots of solid black. A clean-limbed horse, strong and fast, with quick, intelligent eyes and interested ears. When they had bunched to start their ride, Laredo Shad had stopped to stare at the horse, walking around it admiringly.
You're lucky, friend. That's a horse. Where'd you find him?
Navajo Remuda,
He's a Nez Perce warhorse, a long ways off his reservation.
Kedrick had noticed the men as they gathered and how they all sized him up carefully, noting his western garb and especially the low-hung, tied-down guns. They had seen him yesterday, and the store clothes he had worn from New Orleans, but now they could size him up better, judge him with their own kind. He was tall and straight, and of his yesterday's clothing only the black flat-crowned hat remained, the hat and the high-heeled rider's boots. He wore a gray wool shirt now and a black silk kerchief around his neck. His jeans were black, and the two guns rode easily in position, ready for the swing of his hand. Kedrick had seen them bunch, and while they were all there, he had said simply, "All right, let's go." They had mounted up. Kedrick had noted slender, wiry Donny Shaw, the great bulk of Cy Fessenden, lean, bitter Poinsett, the square blonde Lee Goff, sour-faced Clawson, the oldest of the lot, and the lean Texan Laredo Shad. Moving out, he had glanced at them. Whatever else they might be, they were fighting men. Several times Shaw had glanced at his guns.
"You ain't wearing Colts?"
"No, 44 Russians. They are a good gun, one of the most accurate ever built." He had indicated the trail ahead with a nod. "You've been out this way before?"
"Yeah, we got quite a ride. Well, Nunez Spring, I know, just over the North Fork. There's some deep canyons to cross, then a big peak. The Indians in Spanish call it the Orphan. All wild country. Right behind there, we'll begin striking a few of them."
He grinned a little, showing his white, even teeth.
"They're scattered all over Hell's Half Acre."
"Dorn," Goff had asked suddenly, "you figure on riding over to the Malpius this trip?" Clawson had chuckled.
"Sure he will. He should have give up long ago, but he's sure hard to whip. That girl has set her sights higher than any West Country gunslinger."
"She's shapely at that," Goff was openly admiring. "Right, shapely. But playing no favorites."
"Maybe they're playing each other for what they can get," Poinsett had said wryly. "Maybe that's where he gets all the news he's telling Keith. He sure seems to know a sight of what's going around."
Dorney Shaw had turned in his saddle, and his thin features had sharpened.
"Shut up," he had said coldly.
The older man had tightened, and his eyes had blazed back with genuine hate. Yet he had held his peace. It was educational to see how quickly he quieted down. For Poinsett, a hard, vicious man with no love for anybody or anything, obviously wanted no part of what Shaw could give him. As the day drew on, Kedrick studied the men and noticed they all avoided giving offense to Shaw. Even the burly Fessenden, who had killed 20 men and was the only one of the group Kedrick had ever seen before. He wondered if Fessenden remembered him and decided he would know before the day was out. Around the noon camp, there was less friendly banter than in a cow camp. These men were surly and touchy. Only Shaw seemed to relax much, and everything came easily for him. Clawson seemed to take over the cooking job by tacit consent, and the reason was soon obvious. He was really an excellent cook. As he ate, Tom Kedrick studied his situation with care. He had taken this job in New Orleans, and at the time had needed money badly. Gunter had put up the cash to get him out here, and if he did back out, he would have to find a way to repay him. Yet the more he looked over this group, the more he believed that he was into something that he wanted out of, but fast. He had fought as a soldier of fortune in several wars. War had been his profession, and he had been a skilled fighting man almost from the beginning. His father, a one-time soldier, had a love for tactics, and Tom had grown up with an interest in things military. His education had mostly come from his father and from a newspaper man who lived with him for a winter and helped to teach the boy what he could. Kedrick had entered the army and fought through the Civil War. The subsequent fighting had given him a practical background to accompany his study in theory. But with all his fighting and the killing it had entailed, he had not become callous. To run a bunch of renegades off the land seemed simple enough, and it promised action and excitement. It was a job he could do. Now, he was no longer sure it was a job he wanted to do. For his talk with Day Reed, as well as the attitude of so many people in Mustang, had convinced him that all was not as simple as it had first appeared.
Now, before taking a final step, he wanted to survey the situation and see just who he would be fighting and where. At the same time, he knew the men who rode with him were going to ask few questions. They would do their killing, collect their money, and ride on. Of them all, only Shad might think as he did, and Kedrick made a mental note to talk with the Texan before the day was over. Find out where he stood and what he knew. He was inclined to agree with Shaw's original judgment that Shad was one of the best of the lot with a gun. The man's easy way was not only natural to him, he was simply confident with that hard confidence that comes only from having measured his ability and knowing what he could do when the chips were down. After he finished his coffee, he got to his feet and strolled over to the spring, had a drink, then arose and walked to his horse, tightening the cinch he had loosened when they stopped. The air was clear, and despite their lowered voices, he could catch most of what was said. The first question he missed, but Fessenden's reply he heard.
"Don't you fret about him. He's a scrapper from way back, Dorney. I found that out. This here ain't our first meeting."
Even at this distance, and with his horse between him and the circle of men, Kedrick could sense their attention.
"Tried to finagle him out of that Patterson herd up in Injun territory. He didn't finagle worth a damn."
"What happened?" Goff demanded.
"Any shooting?" "Some. I was riding partners with Chuck Gibbons, the Yano gunman, and Chuck was always on the prod, sorta. Two times I figured I might have to shoot it out with him my own self, but wasn't exactly honing for trouble. We had too good a thing there to bust up quarreling. But Chuck, he was plumb salty, and when Kedrick faced him and wouldn't back down or deliver the cattle, Chuck called him."
Fessenden sipped his coffee while they waited impatiently. When they could stand the suspense no longer, Goff demanded,
"Well, what happened?"
The big man shrugged.
"Kedrick's here, ain't he? I mean, what was the story?" "Gibbons never cleared leather. None of us even seen Kedrick draw. But you could have put a half dollar over the two holes in Chuck's left shirt pocket."
Nobody spoke after that, and Tom Kedrick took his time over the cinch. Then, with his horse between them, he walked away farther and circled, scouting the terrain thoughtfully. He was too experienced a man to fail to appreciate how important his knowledge of terrain. All this country from Mustang to the territorial line would become a battleground in the near future, and a man's life might depend on what he knew, so he wanted an opportunity to study the country or ask questions. He had handled tough groups before, and he was not disturbed over the problem they presented, although in this case, he knew the situation was much more serious. In a group, they would be easier to handle than separately, for these men were individualists all, and without any group loyalty. They had faith in only two things in the last analysis: six-gun skill and money. By these they lived, and by these they would die. That Fessenden had talked was pleasing, for it would settle the doubts of some of them, at least. Knowing him for a gun hand, they would more willingly accept orders from him, not because of fear, but rather because they knew him for one of their own, and not some stranger brought in for command. When they moved out, taking their time, the heat had increased. Not a thing stirred on the wide, shallow face of the desert, but a far and lonely buzzard that floated, high and alone, over a far-off mesa. Tom Kedrick's eyes roamed the country ceaselessly. And yet from time to time his thoughts kept reverting to the girl on the veranda. Connie Duane was a beautiful girl, Gunter's niece, but apparently not approving all he did. Why was she here? What was her connection with Keith? Kedrick sensed the animosity of Keith and welcomed it. A quiet man, he was slow to anger, but tough, and when pushed, a deep-seated anger arose within him in a black tide that made him a driving fury. Knowing this rage that lay dormant within him, he rode carefully, talked carefully, and held his temper and his hand. Dorney Shaw drew up suddenly.
"This here is Largo Canyon," he said, waving his hand down the rift before them.
That peak ahead and on your right is the Orphan. Engines won't let no white man up there, but they say there's a spring with a good flow of water on top. Yonder begins the country in the Berwick, Keith, and Gunter by. They don't have the land solid to the Arizona border, but they've got a big chunk of it. The center of the squatters is a town called Yellow Butte. There's maybe 10, 12 buildings there. Among them a store, a stable, corrals, a saloon, and a bank.
Kedrick nodded thoughtfully. The country before him was high desert, and could under no circumstances be called swamp. In the area where he stood there was little growth, a few patches of curly mesquite grass or black grama, with prickly pear, soapweed, creosote bush, and catclaw scattered through it. In some of the washes he saw the deeper green of pinyon, or juniper. They pushed on, entered the canyon, and emerged from it, heading due west. He rode warily, and once, far off on his left, he glimpsed a horseman. Later, seeing the same rider, nearer than before, he deduced they were under observation and hoped there would be no attack. Dorney Shaw said, "The country where most of the squatters are is right smack dab in the middle of the range the company is after. The hombre most likely to head 'em is Bob McLennan. He's got him two right-hand men named Pete Slagle and Pitt Lane. Now, you asked me the other day if they would fight. Them three are Shinnery Oak. Slagle's an oldish feller, but McLennan's in his 40s and was once a Cowtown marshal. Lane, well, he's a tough one to figure, but he packs two guns and cuts him a wide swath over there. I hear tell he had him some gun trouble up Durango way, and he didn't need no help to handle it."
From behind him, Kedrick heard a low voice mutter, "Most as hard to figure as his sister."
Shaw's mouth tightened, but he gave no other evidence that he had heard. But the comment added a little to Kedrick's information. Obviously, Dorney Shaw had a friend in the enemy's camp, and the information with which he had been supplying Keith must come from that source. Was the girl betraying her own brother and her friends? It could be. But could Shaw come and go among them without danger? Or did he worry himself about it? There had been no mention of Day Reed, yet the powerful little Welshman was sure to be a figure wherever he stood, and he was definitely a man to be reckoned with. Suddenly, a rider appeared from an arroyo not 30 yards off and walked her horse toward them. Dorney Shaw swore softly and drew up. As one man, they all stopped. The girl was small, well-made. Her skin was brown as that of an Indian, her hair coal black. She had large, beautiful eyes and small hands. Her eyes flashed from Dorney to the others, then clung to Tom Kedrick, measuring him for a long minute.
"Who's your friend, Dorney?" she said. "Introduce me."
Shaw's eyes were dark and hard as he turned slightly.
"Captain Kedrick, I want you to meet Sue Lane."
"Captain?"
She studied him anew.
"We in the army?"
"Yes," he said quietly. Her pinto was not the horse of the rider who had been observing them. Therefore, there was another rider out there somewhere. Who was he?
"You're riding quite a ways from home, Sue," Shaw interrupted. "You think that's wise?"
"I can take care of myself, Dorney."
Her reply was cool, and Kedrick saw blood rise under Shaw's skin. "However, I came to warn you, or Captain Kedrick, if he is in charge. It won't be safe to ride any farther. McLennan called a meeting this morning, and they voted to open fire on any party of surveyors or strange riders they see. From now on, this country is closed. A rider is going to Mustang tonight with the news."
"There she is," Goff said dryly. "They are sure enough asking for it. What if we ride on anyway?"
She glanced at him.
"Then they will be fighting," she said quietly.
"Well," Poinsett said impatiently, "what are we talking for? We come here to fight, didn't we? Let's ride on in and see how much battle they got in 'em."
Tom Kedrick studied the girl thoughtfully. She was pretty, all right. Very pretty. She lacked the quiet beauty of Connie Duane, but she did have beauty.
"Do they have scouts out?" he asked.
She glanced at him. "Not yet, but they will have," she smiled. "If they had, I'd never have dared ride to warn you." "Whose side are you on, Miss Lane?" Kedrick asked. Dorney Shaw's head came around sharply, and his eyes blazed. Before he could speak, Sue Lane answered for herself.
"That decision I make for myself. My brother doesn't make it for me, nor any one of them. They're fools to fight over this desert."
Contemptuously, she waved a hand at it.
"There's no more than a bare living on it anyway. If they lose, maybe we can leave this country."
She swung her horse abruptly.
"Well, you've had your warning. Now I'll go back."
"I'll be riding your way," Shaw interposed.
Her eyes swung back to him.
"Don't bother."
Then she turned her attention deliberately to Kedrick and measured him again with her cool eyes, a hint of a smile in them now.
"If anybody comes, let Captain Kedrick come. They don't know him."
Somebody in the group chuckled, and Dorney Shaw swung his horse, his face white as death. His teeth were bared, his right hand poised.
"Who laughed?"
he said, his voice almost trembling. "Miss Lane," Kedrick said quietly, "I think Dorney Shaw could make the trip better than I. He knows the country." Shaw's eyes glittered.
"I asked, who laughed?"
Kedrick turned his head.